This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This is The Informer, Australia's only LGBTIQ+ national news and current affairs show. Proudly sponsored by KHQ Lawyers. Passionate about being the best.
Well, Toby, it's been quite a year in politics in Australia. What are your thoughts?
Well, yeah, it certainly has. Like, I think in the election earlier this year in May, where Scott Morrison won another term for the Conservatives, we've kind of seen the culmination of some trends that have been manifesting in elections in the United States and the United Kingdom for a little while, that I think were concealed in Australia by Malcolm Turnbull. Malcolm Turnbull was seen, and this has kind of been shown in a number of polls. If you look at polling that was done in regional Queensland, in outer metropolitan seats in New South Wales, he was seen as quite elitist, as there being a disconnect between him and ordinary Australians. And Scott Morrison kind of reset that mentality for a lot of people. And look, for all the commentary off the back of that election about Labor, about policies, about candidates, I think some of that probably did have merit. Labor's review it conducted after the election revealed quite a few issues. The overall trend is a much larger one that is impacting on the Western world generally. There's some quite compelling trends that look, have been remarked on by others, but if you look at the last kind of 20, 30 years in the West, we're kind of in a period that's described as the fourth industrial revolution, where you're seeing the rise of AI, a whole variety of digital technologies and automation. And that basically is leaving a lot of people feeling like they're no longer needed by the modern Western economy. And it's kind of a hard thing to admit, and that's part of the reason why very few people in politics say it out loud. But the really challenging truth is that a lot of them aren't actually required by the modern economy. People are being replaced by machines, and that presents an existential challenge, I think, to modern liberal democracies. And it just so happens that social democratic and Labor parties around the world are facing those challenges first, because a large section of their base, they tend to be a little bit older. They tend to be, they've got a lower level of higher education, but I think it's really important to be clear that that's doesn't mean that people aren't intelligent or informed. I think often when that kind of category of voter has been characterized, people kind of tend to throw in a whole lot of labels, and actually, and it's true for a section of that voting base, but actually overall, I think they're pretty conscious of the fact that they are left out of public narratives, that they tend not to be portrayed in media in a range of ways, that, you know, their stories aren't being told by Hollywood and by television. And so they understandably feel quite threatened, and that's kind of reflected in their voting patterns. And I think that's basically the trend that you saw reflected in Scott Morrison's win. He ran a campaign that felt safe, a campaign that ran on underlying values that a lot of people can happily subscribe to, and that was part of the reason why he won.
With the Labor campaign, there were certainly some things that might have made people quite concerned. You know, we talk about franking credits, and as a younger person, it's pretty easy to dismiss the importance of it. But when you have no more income coming in because you're not working, you're retired, that's a big threat.
Yeah, I think it's the kind of policy decision where, like, if you actually look at it in terms of pure policy, like, it's pretty clearly a good idea, yeah, in terms of the economics of it. Like, you can see why on paper people supported it in principle. There's a lot of actually economists that you might typically characterise as right-wing who would back a policy like that, because economically franking credits are actually kind of inefficient. Like, you're basically channeling resources to a subset of the population that are pretty well off already, but it is, as you say, the kind of policy that is very easily subjected to not even a scare campaign, like a campaign where, because it's hard to explain the underlying policy settings, the only category of voter who really understands it is a voter who probably benefits from it. And that means that it's potentially subject to being presented to the larger electorate in a way that makes it very easy to mischaracterize it. I think that I'm sure Labor will take some lessons away from that in terms of how they run future campaigns. Mm-hmm. It's also worth, I think, flagging that there was another issue that came up in terms of how digital platforms regulate fake news in particular. And I think this is going to be, this is obviously something that's been an issue since 2016 in the US campaign. Mm-hmm. But there were a number of memes and stories that were circulating that suggested that Bill Shorten and Sally McManus, who's the head of the Australian Council of Trade Unions, had said things that they just hadn't said, basically. And Facebook actually made a ruling that basically they weren't going to regulate that kind of news. And so there's a genuine tension here around the role of social media companies and the role they play in regulating political debate and news. And I think there's actually quite a complex conversation to be had. And I think one of the issues is it doesn't really seem like that conversation's happening really. I think it is happening amongst certain politicians. There's going to be a Senate inquiry about the impact of digital media. Yeah. But I don't think that debate is happening in the wider community much, because there is a genuine question, about do we want Facebook regulating political debate? What does that look like? They continue to say they're not a media company when really by most standards they really are. They're almost a super media company. Yeah. And so that's a really complex problem that I think poses particular challenges for democracies, and that right-wing parties, like one thing that's worth kind of telling people actually is that the same group of campaigners, there's a core group of campaigners who now campaigned on Donald Trump's 2016 campaign, mm-hmm. on the Brexit campaign. They worked on Scott Morrison's campaign and they worked on Boris Johnson's successful UK election campaign recently. Yep. And they have worked out how to campaign in a modern digital space. And I don't think that progressive parties, not just the Labor Party, but that goes for the Greens as well, that goes for the Lib Dems and Labor in the UK, mm-hmm. for the Democratic candidates in the US, I don't think there's that coordinated core of campaigners that you have on the right, basically.
That kind of reminds me of 2000 in the US with George Bush and Al Gore. And in Florida, there were quite a number of people who voted for Ralph Nader because they couldn't stomach Al Gore. But the number of votes for Ralph Nader was certainly a lot more than the 500-odd that divided Bush versus Gore.
Yeah, there's a real challenge for progressives too, that we are spending a lot of resources fighting one another, basically. That's true in Australia. It's true in the UK. I think we often tend to get caught up in arguing with one another and arguing about the leaves on the trees, if you like. You know, like the Greens and Labor will both have a crack at one another over very specific things that the other party's allegedly or has done. And we're missing the larger context that this trend is being replicated in a whole range of different countries. And that kind of suggests that there are actually underlying causes that we all need to actually try to take a step back, I think, and talk about, because we're always going to find other reasons to argue with one another when the larger opponents that we have, if you like, pose a much bigger threat to all of us, to our way of life, and frankly to our underlying values.
I think it's fair to say that the conservative values in Australia aren't necessarily the majority view, that Australians, when they're polled at least, tend to be a little bit more left than this government, for sure.
I think that's absolutely true. What Scott Morrison, because he was able to run a small target strategy, he didn't talk about increasing the regulation of the unions, even though we've now seen that the Ensuring Integrity Bill, which is basically a bill that cracks down on union officials, has now been before the Parliament twice. While there has been overwhelming support within the community for increasing regulation of the banks, yet the Morrison government hasn't brought forward any of the reforms that it committed to making after the Hayne Royal Commission. I think Morrison demonstrated as well during the bushfire crisis that's still ongoing that he's got a really thin ear with some of this stuff. I think for the first time, a number of Australians who possibly voted for Scott Morrison, and you've seen this on social media quite a lot, have been saying, hang on, what's this guy doing? What's happening here? And certainly the optics of thousands of volunteers, many of whom have been working since August, who are doing unpaid work, defending their homes in really challenging, dangerous conditions. The optics of the Prime Minister of Australia going to Hawaii on holiday, having declared that they didn't need any further resources, that they didn't deserve to be paid in any way or remunerated in any way. And while he's not taking any action of climate change, may have perhaps made a few people aware that Scott Morrison actually is part of the elite swamp that he talks about draining. So it'll be interesting to see whether that actually registers with people or sticks around. But I imagine for a few people, it will have become apparent that perhaps he's not the ordinary everyday bloke that he markets himself as. He was, after all, the head of Tourism Australia.
And he approved the Where the Bloody Hell Are You ad, and that's what kicked him out.
Well, that's exactly. Yep, absolutely. And that's what I think a lot of people were asking, quite literally using hashtags on Twitter, when he was in Hawaii while much of New South Wales was burning.
But Toby, now is not the time for political point scoring, as we've been told, which is sort of denying half of the conversation, I think.
Well, absolutely. It's a very well thought out marketing technique that they have borrowed directly from the NRA. And conservatives are offended by this suggestion. But I think that's the reality that we're seeing. We are seeing a lot of tactics being shared by Republicans and by conservative Tories in the UK with the Liberals and the Nationals here in Australia. And like those tactics get rolled out in a way to silence debate, basically, and to avoid having the debate entirely. Scott Morrison has quite a dismissive and quite arrogant style. And like, I think it's probably fair to say with the crackdowns you've seen on journalists, like a style that does tend towards the autocratic when it comes to debating free speech. Like, he's much more likely to completely dismiss a question than answer it. Now, whether that winds up being a tendency that causes him problems at elections, I think remains to be seen. But I think, as you were saying before, his approach to politics does seem to be much more conservative than your average Australian. The Religious Freedom Bill, for example, is a pretty good example of that. I think that's a bill where they are relying on getting it through without there being much scrutiny of what the actual provisions will mean, because that bill, if it's passed in its present form, will allow doctors to not just refuse to provide women who are seeking help with, say, accessing contraception or being referred on to a doctor to provide them an abortion. Doctors will be able to refuse to provide those services to women at all. There are no requirements that they need to advertise that they will do that, for example. Like, there's a bunch of, I think, quite reasonable assumptions people might have about people's ability to access certain kinds of medical services that will be denied and changed by these laws in really fundamental ways. But none of that's being acknowledged by the government. That's not what they're talking about. The stuff they're talking about is, frankly, strawman examples that aren't really applicable in almost all cases. There's this classic example that's used, of a baker being able to refuse to serve, to make a cake for a gay wedding, as if that's the...
And that's one that just keeps coming around and around. It's kind of bizarre. I mean, it's a cake.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, exactly. But the reason conservatives use that example is because it's not actually typical of the kinds of changes they are seeking to make. And to most people, it's like, oh, cake, we'll just get the cake baked elsewhere. Like, it's the most reasonable example of their ideology at play, if you like, when actually the way these kinds of legal changes will impact and where they'll impact is in rural communities where, say, you might have a doctor or you might even have a dentist or someone who provides a range of other services. It might be an aged care home. It might be a school. And you'll have, say, a gay couple who want to send their daughter or their son to that school. And you might have that couple being refused the right to send their child to a school when there isn't another school for 100 kilometres. You might have someone being refused medical services because they have a particular faith or they are of a particular sexual identity and there isn't another doctor for hundreds of kilometres. Now, they don't use that example because most people would immediately recognise that that's unreasonable and unfair and is actually a form of pretty extreme discrimination.
Well, on Trans Day of Remembrance, I attended the vigil at Fitzroy Town Hall, and we put it to air last month. And one of the things that came out of that were there are two stories about people who were trans and didn't feel like they could get the healthcare that they needed, or in one case was denied, and someone had a relatively easily treatable cancer and ended up dying from that because of that fear.
Absolutely.
And I think that's something that we can't forget is that, you know, you and I are both cis white men and our lives are, you know, fairly easy compared to a lot of others. And I think it's important just to remember that, you know, everyone's going through their own things and we need to support our community. And I'm really just rambling.
No, but I think you're completely right though. Yeah. Like, I think it's particularly important, like within our community, to have empathy for one another and to recognize that it's actually really important to display solidarity. Like, to be completely frank, you know, I think this would be true of both you and I. We would, if we were discriminated against by, say, a doctor or by a provider of some kind, we would both have the financial resources and geographically we'd be proximate to alternative services. We could also go on social media and almost immediately get like a response from people who are supportive of what's happening to us. But if you talk about LGBTIQ plus Australians who might have English as their second language, or they might be older, or they might be in a regional or a rural area, or they might not be out to their families, they might be really young. Those people are really vulnerable, and they're the people who these kinds of legal changes are going to have a really, really serious impact on. So I think it's very important, and I know that Joy's been campaigning really hard against these laws, and a lot of LGBTIQ plus organisations have been doing the same thing, but I think it's really important that we maintain a strong position against the right to hate being enshrined in Australian law, because this is really not – they are looking for a problem to solve here. This is basically a very small subset of the Australian population who have views that are out of sync with most religious Australians. And it's been amazing how many Christian Australians and Muslim Australians and Australians from all walks of, from all different faiths I've spoken to, who don't think we need these laws at all and who are really shocked at the campaign to introduce them. We need to make it clear that these laws aren't representative of most Australians.
Before I let you go, looking forward into 2020, do you think we're going to have a Royal Commission over the bushfires in New South Wales? And what do you think some of the political ramifications of that might be?
Yeah, I think we may. As I'm sure most people are, I'm really hopeful that we don't see any more properties destroyed or any more deaths. But one of the issues with this incredibly lengthy fire season is that a lot of towns are just running out of water and a lot of volunteers are really, really tired. So I hope that there are no more serious ramifications from this fire season. But I think if we do, there will be a really strong push for there to be scrutiny of the decisions the New South Wales government's made. They did cut resources to the Rural Firefighting Service and decisions the Morrison government's made in, for example, refusing to meet ex-firefighters who were calling for more resources. I think there will be a push for more scrutiny. And you would think that that would probably come about But it is worth saying that royal commissions are this government's way, and to be fair, like a lot of governments have used this tactic, it's a way of basically prolonging scrutiny of problems, yeah? You push things back by a year and a half, and you hope that people will forget about what happened. It hasn't always worked out that way, but with things like the Banking Royal Commission, you can see pretty clearly that, you know, they've just gradually slowed their response so that the pressure to make these kinds of reforms disappears because another crisis emerges, basically, and takes the place of those stories about the victims of avarice from the banks. So hopefully we won't need to have a Royal Commission. I think clearly there needs to be changes, but I think you will be hearing a lot more said about Australia's policies when it comes to firefighting next year.
Great. And one final question. Sorry, I lied. Did you see Barnaby Joyce's video that he released yesterday?
I did see it. I did see Barnaby's video. Look, a lot of people were laughing at the video. It was very strange. And look, it is very funny. It is he's an odd man. But I've got to say, like, I was quite concerned about him, you know, like, to be clear, I think Barnaby's probably reached the point where he's offered all he can in terms of his contribution to public life. But he seemed quite unwell to me in that video. He does actually have a couple of very young children with his new partner, Vicky Campion. He does have four, you know, adult children. And, like, I wonder whether it isn't time for him to seriously think about stepping back from politics because, yeah, it's just not clear to me that he's handling the pressure particularly well. So, yeah, I appreciate that sort of very funny take on it. But
no, I think it's a very honest one and, you know, the kind of dialogue we really should be having. Yeah, he's always been an interesting politician and he's certainly survived quite a bit without it harming him. And I know that the people in his area who support him really love him and they're quite a majority.
Yeah.
But
I think that's right. I reckon a lot of people would probably have the view that Barnaby should possibly think about moving on now, like even mm-hmm. people who once may have supported him. Like, I think we do need strong rural politicians. Like, it's particularly important now given the enormous challenges the bush is facing. Mm-hmm. But I just don't think Barnaby's demonstrated the ability to deliver for his community, to be frank. Like, he's gotten distracted by, frankly, bullshit, you know?
Yeah.
Like, he's a distraction politician. He's, you know, the kind of guy who has not actually delivered for his community with any consistency. So I think it'd probably be better for everyone, especially Barnaby, if he thought about doing something else.
Well, it'll be interesting to watch in the coming year.
Absolutely.
Well, Toby, I'll let you get back to your barbecue.
Thank you very much, Aaron. No. We are moving the barbecue in as we speak. So, it was lovely to have a chat. And I hope you have a very, very happy New Year. Same to everyone listening to The Informer and Joy, and I look forward to chatting to you in the new year.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.